slaves running for his life because he was being hunted by the king. It could be after his son Absalom was killed, and Absalom had killed his brother and proceeded to take over David's kingdom. If you remember that story where Absalom kills his brother in revenge for what happened to his sister, and then he's exiled, and when he comes back, David excludes him from being in the court, and as a result, Absalom begins to turn the hearts away from David and take over the kingdom, and David has to flee for his life. It could be some other situation in David's life that we don't know. We know that there were a lot of circumstances in his life where he was under duress and under trial. It's not necessary to understand the context exactly of what David is referring to here as he writes this psalm, but we do know from what we read here that the situation was bleak. Victory seemed out of reach, humanly speaking. Evil seemed to be winning. David's adversaries were hunting him, ready to attack, sneaking up by stealth. A few weeks ago, we looked at Psalm 10, and Psalm 10 was a psalm of lament. And it's good to recognize the evil that's in this world. There is a place for us as believers to realize that we live in a fallen world that is filled with sin and sickness and sadness and death, that's filled with injustice, that's filled with depravity. And there is a place in the Christian life where we properly lament over the sin that we see around us. Although we live on, as Christians, we live on this side of the cross, but we're still in this time, as theologians refer to as the already but not yet. Salvation has come, but the full expression of that salvation we wait for following the return of Christ. And so we're in this time where both we've experienced forgiveness of sin and new life, and yet we live in a fallen world, and we struggle with indwelling sin even in our own lives. And so at times we should lament. However, we should not be discouraged and disillusioned. We should not despair and lose hope. And that's the purpose why David writes this psalm. David begins at the opening of this with an exclamation of trust. And that's what we see first in the first words of this verse. David writes, "In the Lord I take refuge." And I want to stop there because David transitions after this exclamation of his absolute confidence in the person of God. David begins by putting a stake in the ground. I was looking up that phrase as I was thinking about this passage, and one writer wrote this, and again, I don't know if this is actually true or not, but from what he said, to drive a stake in the ground is a Native American term. And he says, when they were under attack and it looked like they were going to be defeated, they would drive a stake into the ground and actually tie a person by the leg to it so that they would have to stay there and defend that piece of ground to the death. Whether if that's apocryphal or reality, the idea behind it is what David is doing here. He's putting a stake in the ground. He's saying, this is the truth that I am standing on. This is the reality in which I live. In the Lord I take refuge. Like the Apostle Paul, like the Apostle John, he knows one thing. John writes this in 1 John 4:4. He says, "Little children, you are from God and have overcome them, for he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." You see, David wasn't naive to the reality of the situation he faced. It wasn't as if he was just, pie in the sky by and just going along and ignoring the reality of the world that he lived in. He full well understood the reality of the situation that he was in. But he said, "In the Lord I take refuge." He uses here the name of God, Yahweh. And Mounts in his dictionary defines Yahweh this way. He says, "Yahweh is the proper name of the one true God. Knowledge and use of the name implies personal or covenantal relationship. The name pictures God as the one who exists and or causes existence. So it's in the Lord Yahweh that he takes refuge. The idea of covenant, as we've talked about before, is greater than the cultural concept of unconditional love. Unconditional love is indiscriminate and non-committal. It's a sentiment regardless of circumstances. In covenantal love, God pledges himself for our good and his glory because we are his children. He makes a promise to himself to faithfully work in his life, that he has sworn to it, and he will do what he has said he is going to do. And so David here at the beginning of this psalm, when he puts a stake in the ground, he says, regardless of the circumstances that surround me, this I know, that the Lord Yahweh, in his covenant love, is protecting me. And it's in him that I take refuge. Well, there's a reason for that, and we find that immediately following this first statement, and that is the demoralizing advice that he receives. I don't think they intended to give him demoralizing advice. These were his advisors that were talking to him. These were those who were close to him, those who he knew and those who he trusted. And he says this, how can you say to my soul? He questions them. He questions what they say. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrows to the string to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what shall the righteous do? This was demoralizing advice to David. I don't think they recognized it. There were unintended consequences. They thought they were saying something that was well-meaning, but they were wrong. We need to say the right things at the right time in the right way. Proverbs 15:23 says, to make an apt answer is a joy to man, and a word in season, how good is it? Well, why was this such bad advice? Why is David confronting his advisors with this advice that they're giving him? And the reason is, as we'll see, is that they focus on the problem without considering God. Now, running away isn't always the wrong thing to do. The Bible sometimes tells us to run. For instance, in 2 Timothy 2:22, it says, so flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. Paul reminds us that if we try to stay and fight against youthful lust, eventually we will lose. But here, because there was no consideration of God, the situation seemed insurmountable. They were pessimistic, bordering on hopeless, because they were only thinking about this from a human perspective. You see, a lot of times when we come to problems, we see things only horizontally, and we come with our own reasoning on the circumstances, and we don't recognize that God is in the midst of our problems, and he is the one who is at work, and he will work in ways that we can't understand or comprehend. If we do things his way, he is for us, and he is the one who is acting. It's not just up to us to figure out a solution and work things out in our own way. But because they were only thinking about this from a human perspective, they thought the only solution was to run away. Notice what they say here. Flee like a bird to your mountain. Run, escape, get away, go to your hideout. Joseph ran from Potiphar's wife. Paul escaped when the Jews were trying to kill him in Damascus. If running away isn't always wrong, why was this not the right thing here? It's because it was based on fear rather than faith. They were looking at the situation from a human perspective, and they forgot about God. Look, they share their concerns, and these are legitimate concerns. The enemy is about to attack. Their weapons are at the ready. They're stealthy and they shoot from the shadows. They'll get you before you even know it. They are overwhelming and will overpower us. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The problem, they're probably not wrong about their assessment when they're looking at the problem. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? There's this sense of hopelessness that we find here. And I think sometimes we feel the same way when we look at the culture that we live in. That there's a sense of discouragement and perhaps sometimes disillusionment. As a culture, we no longer hold to biblical marriage. Marriage has been redefined to mean any two people. We've redefined the family. The idea of a mother and father in covenant marriage is no longer the ideal. We live in a sex-saturated culture. They use it to sell hamburgers and car tires. We've cheapened life with abortion and euthanasia. Abortion has become a form of birth control, and euthanasia is population control. Subjective identity rules over biology, genetics, science, nature, and logic. We see the proliferation of drugs and the increase of violence in our society. Mass murders and school shootings have become so commonplace, we have become numb to them and expect them as a normal price of living in this country. The collapse of the Judeo-Christian ethic in the larger culture. We now live not only in a post-Christian culture, but in an anti-Christian culture. Author Aaron Wren outlines what he calls the three worlds of Christianity, and we might quibble about the exact dates of these, but I believe his observations are spot on. He says, we used to live in a positive world. He says, prior to 1994, 95, he said, society at large retained a mostly positive view of Christianity. To be known as a good church-going man remains part of being an upstanding citizen. Publicly being a Christian is a status enhancer. Christian moral norms are the basic norms of society, and violating them can bring negative consequences. He said, but for the next 20 years, from about 1994 to 2014, we lived in a neutral world. He said, society took a neutral stance towards Christianity. Christianity no longer has privileged status, but it's not disfavored. Being publicly known as a Christian has neither a positive nor a negative impact on one's social standing. Christianity is a valid option within the pluralistic public square. Christian moral norms retain some residual effect. But he said, since that time, since around 2014, we live in a negative world. Society has come to have a negative view of Christianity. Being known as a Christian is a social negative, particularly in the elite domains of society. Christian morality is expressly repudiated and seen as a threat to the public good and the new public moral order. Subscribing to Christian moral views or violating the secular moral order brings negative consequences. The foundations are being destroyed. What can the righteous do? It seems like a reasonable question. What can the righteous do? Do we do like Noah and build an ark and gather together and wait for God's judgment? Or as the advisors say here, do we run to the hills and escape? What is our response? Run for cover? Withdraw from culture? Despondency and despair? Worry and wringing our hands? Maybe our response is anger, and as we've seen, even violence. Well, David's point here is, although the advisor's advice might be reasonable, it's wrong. Notice what he continues to say. He talks about the foundation of faith here, and this is where we need to land, where David's feet were firmly planted and where our feet need to be. He talks about the foundation of faith beginning in verse 4. Through the end of the chapter, he first of all says, the Lord is in his holy temple. We have faith in an omnipotent God. God is all powerful. God is seated on his throne and will not be moved. He cannot be shaken. This is the heavenly temple where he is seated on his throne in power and glory. Let me just read a few verses from Isaiah chapter 40. He says, behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as the dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are counted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness compares to him? A few verses later, he continues. He says, do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretch out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. Isaiah wants us to recognize the power, the glory, the grandeur of God seated on his throne, and nothing, nothing, nothing compares to him. The world can align against him. And this is what it says in Psalm 2. He says, why do the nations rage and peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. And then it says, he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Men may plot and plan and scheme. They may rebel and shake their fist at God, but God is not moved from his throne. We have an omnipotent God that we serve. David then tells us that we have an omniscient God, a God who sees everything. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of men. In Psalm 139, at the beginning of the psalm, David writes, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You see when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in, behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. God knows us because he is with us. He is an ever-present help in time of trouble. He said he will never leave us. He will never forsake us. That he will be with us always, even until the end of the age. This is a cause of comfort for those who know him and fear for those who don't. The Lord sees my struggles and he is with me. The Lord sees my sins because he is with me. But in spite of that, because I am his covenant child, the Lord loves me and promises, pledges himself to me because of Christ. We have faith in the justice of God. Notice what the psalmist goes on. And he says, the Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. He tests the hearts of man. The Lord vindicates the righteous and judges the guilty. We have faith in the grace of God. And we, as believers, this side of the cross, are in a much better place to fully understand it than David did. David looked forward to the promise of the Messiah. David looked forward to what God was going to do. We on this side of the cross look back with full understanding of God's revelation as we read through the New Testament of what he did in providing forgiveness of sins as Christ died on the cross to take the penalty for our sin and rose again to offer new life to us. John Calvin notes this in his book, The Institutes. He says this, nearly all the wisdom we possess, that is to say, true and sound wisdom, consists of two parts, the knowledge of God and of ourselves. If we understand God's holiness and our sinfulness, apart from the cross, we find despair. If we understand the reality of who God truly is in his holiness, and we have a glimpse of our sinful heart apart from Jesus, we recognize that we deserve justice. But as believers, when we see God's glory, when we see His holiness, and when we see our sinfulness, the beauty of the cross, of His forgiveness, of His grace, of His mercy, of His acceptance, of our cleansing, we understand the reality of God's grace and that justice was poured out for those who are Him on the cross. And it's this grace that motivates us to respond in holiness. And our righteousness by faith does please Him. Now, notice the promise, what it says here. You know, God knows those who are His. He knows those whom He has transformed and those who are living for Him as a response to God's grace. He talks about judgment. He says, let him rain coals on the wicked, fire and sulfur and a scorching wind. We're reminded of the judgment of God that we saw in Sodom and Gomorrah, that we've seen throughout the Old Testament, and the promise that it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. But notice what he says, the promise that David has, that he understood in part, but that we, again, this side of the cross, understand in greater fullness. Notice what he says. He says, "For the Lord is righteous," verse 7, "He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold His face." I don't know if we fully comprehend the impact of what David is saying here. In Exodus 33:20, it says this. God says to Moses, Moses says, "I want to see you." And God responds and says, but He said, "You cannot see My face, for man shall not see Me and live." And Moses was able to see, as it were, a backward glance of the glory of God as it passed through, as he's in the cleft of the rock. In Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah has a vision of God in heaven in His throne. And Isaiah writes about it in chapter 6. He says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon His throne, high and lifted up. And the train of His robe filled the temple. Above Him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two He covered His face, and with two He covered His feet, and with two He flew. And one called out to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory.' And the foundations of the threshing floor shook at the voice of Him who called, and the house was filled with smoke." And Isaiah did the only thing that a rational man would do, and that was he was terrified. And he says, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." He says, I'm coming undone. I've seen a glimpse of God. And it's only God's grace in taking the coal and of cleansing him. Again, pointing to the reality of the cross. John chapter 1, verse 18 in the New Testament says, "No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side has made Him known." God's full glory has been veiled since the fall. Even in Christ, Christ reveals the glory of God even as He veils it in humanity. Only at the transfiguration during the earthly life of Jesus was there even a partial manifestation of His glory. Remember the time when Peter caught a glimpse of Jesus on the boat, and he just has this glimpse of who Jesus is. He says, but when Simon Peter saw it, he saw what Jesus had done. He fell down at Jesus' feet, fell down at Jesus' knees saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." The reality is that up until today, no one on earth has seen the full glory of God in its manifold glory, unfiltered, unveiled. But John tells us in the book of Revelation, chapter 22, after the return of Christ, after the judgment seat of God, there will be a new heavens and a new earth, and God is going to come and dwell with his people. John writes, no longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and the Lamb of God will be in it, and his servants will worship him, and they shall see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. They shall see his face, for we shall behold him as he is. This was the hope of David as he meditated on the reality of God, as he focused on God in this world that is filled with chaos. It's presently under the control of the evil one in many ways. The wicked will seem to prosper. Christians often feel like we're back on our heels. The majority culture is hostile to Christianity in the Western world. Christian beliefs are openly mocked and ridiculed. The whole world celebrates sin and promotes it. Our natural tendency is to withdraw in fear, to lash out in anger. But David gives us a different response. He tells us to focus on God. To see God for who he really is. Do you remember in the Old Testament with Elisha and his servant? Do you remember the time when Elijah and his servant are surrounded by the enemy? And it seems, humanly speaking, like all is lost. You know, the enemy is around him. And in 2 Kings it says this, when the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army of horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? Do we run to the hills? Do we hide? Do we flee? Look at the enemy around us. Look at the world that we live in. Look at the situations that we face every day. Look at the opposition. The majority world is against us. Do we just hunker down and hope for the best and wait for the end? But Elisha says to him, do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see. So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. God will build his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. God will accomplish his plan. We talked about this in Sunday school, and the sovereignty of God and the reality that God is on his throne. And this is what David encourages us. Focus on God. God is omnipotent. He possesses all power. God is omniscient. He sees everything. He knows everything because he's everywhere. God is just. He will right every wrong. And those who have received forgiveness, he will call to himself. God is gracious, and we know that he is gracious because we look at the cross. And one day, with unveiled faces, we will see him face to face.